This is MSCI Perspectives, bringing to light insights and analysis that help global investors tackle today's challenges. I'm your host, Adam Bass, and today is June 6th, 2025. Inflation, interest rates, trade disruption, and beneath it all, fixed income and derivatives markets adapting at speed. With Treasury auctions stirring unease and a dramatic shift in how global investors are positioning, it's no surprise these assets are back in focus. But the questions are bigger than just what or even where to buy. It's about what tools to use, which risks to hedge, and how to think long-term in a world where volatility seems to dominate in the short term. Or, as our first guest, MSCI's Global Head of Fixed Income and Derivatives, George Harrington, put it.
It's certainly been a really dramatic start to the year with the volatility that we've seen across markets. But when we go back to, you know, the kickoff of the tariffs on Liberation Day, and we saw the activity that went on in the market, obviously equities took a pretty significant hit. But that was followed by some very sharp selling in the U.S. Treasury market, especially in the longer end of the curve. And that's really what started to raise alarm bells. And I think that for the administration, you know, there was a lot of pressure on the tariff policy as a result of that, because there was unexpected selling that, you know, really started to accelerate. And just even with the introduction of the Big Beautiful Bill and the expectations on what impact that may have on deficits, you know, that's caused, you know, a second round of concern in terms of where is the economic policy going and what does it mean for the credit quality of the United States? And will some of the traditional buyers of U.S. treasuries start to move away? We've had some positive auctions since then, which has allayed some of the concerns. But now you're also seeing, you know, some more negative reactions regarding how it's going to affect the deficit longer term.
Our second guest today.
I'm Mark Heder, based out of Frankfurt, Germany here, and I am the Global Product Manager for MSCI Fixed Income Indexes.
Built on that idea around the impact on fixed income in particular.
Stress in the fixed income markets is also evident in the mispricing of bonds relative to the yield curve, right? So dislocation metrics such as this, they have increased by 30 to 50% since the start of the tariff turmoil. And this indicates that there are maybe rising frictions in pricing and liquidity in the bond market. So although overall levels remain below levels of previous crisis, the speed of this move is unusual, comparable only to the speed that we saw back in the COVID crisis, and then further back, 2008, in the global financial crisis. And in the corporate bond market, a sharp spike in dislocation during the COVID crisis caused the Federal Reserve to intervene as a buyer of corporate bonds. Whether similar intervention will be necessary this time remains to be seen. And in the Treasury market, the recent dislocation, it may be linked to unwinding of so-called basis trades, commonly cited as potential drivers of treasury market instability. For fixed income portfolio managers, these developments, they signal both accelerating liquidity risk, but also alpha opportunities, especially for those who can quantify and act on the dislocation signals. So the question is, what comes next?
George, any thoughts on that?
I think that there is just a tremendous amount of caution in the market, right? So there's no question that there's been some reallocation to cash. While there's, you know, really unclear direction in terms of where that's going, but I think the bigger sort of fear out there that's lurking is that, again, you know, non-U.S. holders of U.S. treasuries and especially longer end treasuries may start to shy away from the asset class. No, and to the extent that happens, that's going to mean for the U.S. domestically, rising long-term interest rates, and that's going to affect, you know, the mortgage market, you know, our student loans, car loans, everything will be affected by that. So it really reverberates through the economy, you know, very, very loudly and very quickly. And also keep in mind, we've had been in an extremely low interest rate environment for a very, very long time. That started changing with inflation during the last U.S. administration. Rates started rising significantly for the first time in a long time. But that was not because of sell-offs. That was really inflation-driven. And that also the Fed was in an interest rate rising environment. Now the Fed is steady and is holding fast despite pressures to do otherwise. They're holding because they do have their eyes clearly on inflation related to the tariffs. But again, that selling, that core selling of long-dated U.S. Treasuries, while the traditional holders, have always been there for decades, that really, again, sort of shakes the foundation in terms of where we're headed.
We'll dig in further in terms of liquidity risk and some of the other concerns for investors a little later on the program. But sticking with the big picture for now, I'd like to bring in our third guest, and that's Head of Fixed Income and Multi-Asset Class Research at MSCI, Jared Lindsay. Now, Jared doesn't necessarily disagree with his colleagues, but he does have a somewhat different perspective on the impact of the instability.
The reality is, yes, the U.S. is no longer has a AAA rating from any of the major credit agencies. But I don't think it's really shaken up anything in terms of overall global markets. So in fact, the U.S. makes up about 25% of global fixed income as it stands right now. And if we start to look at fixed income as a whole and how it's managed, about 15% of assets are actually indexed within the fixed income space. But when you start to even look at active strategies, those tend to be very closely index aligned, where 60 to 80% of those are beta exposure. So this probably means that 3/4 of fixed income is still aligned to benchmarks in itself, which effectively means that they're going to have structural allocation toward U.S. treasuries. Now, if you start to look at fixed income and you see $33 trillion in fixed income AUM, the more recent downgrade, yes, but there's still a fair amount of confidence. And what we've also seen from investors in itself is that there's been probably more a shift toward short-dated bonds. But when I speak to any of our asset owners and asset managers, there's still allocation toward the U.S. and in treasuries in general. So yes, there's been a bit less sponsorship on the last auction, but I think it's a little bit too early to kind of just go out and say that there's going to be less demand moving forward, just because what the U.S. or what U.S. treasuries mean for overall fixed income market in itself.
That's an interesting perspective and definitely speaks to some of the headline risk versus what may actually be underlining. And just to be clear, you're hearing those same thoughts from clients that they see this maybe, how should I put it, as a blip more than a structural change?
Yeah, because from clients, they're not even looking at the day-to-day. They're looking at more about strategic allocation. So they're looking at yields, they're looking at exposure, they're looking at diversification. They're thinking about fixed income more strategically over the next 5 or 10 years. Hence why I think it's a little bit too early to really say, or if the jury is out, that there's going to be less demand for foreign sponsorship moving forward.
As we heard, Jared's take rests partly on this idea that about 75% of the fixed income market is aligned to benchmarks, indexes. This notion relates to a point that came up when I was speaking with Mark in terms of the significant shift of fixed income investors from active strategies to passive strategies and why that might be happening, especially for those with a focus on sustainability and climate.
I think it is driven by a couple of key factors. Number one is cost efficiency. Everybody knows that passive strategies typically have a lower management fee compared to active strategies. And this cost efficiency in particular is appealing in the fixed income space, where margins are even tighter than on the equity side. Number two is transparency and simplicity. Passive investing offers greater transparency and simplicity. So investors know exactly what they are getting if they replicate an index. Number three is what we call performance consistency. Now, again, it depends a little bit on the specific implementation. So you have low tracking error versus medium or even high tracking error sustainability and climate indexes. But by and large, a passive strategy will give you this performance consistency. And then finally, there is across the board, even though maybe the momentum has slowed down in some parts of the world a little bit over the last, call it 3 years, but still there is an increased demand for sustainability integration. And last but not least, there is also certain regulatory and market trends, so regulatory changes that are increasingly favoring sustainable and climate conscious investments. And this has led to a surge in demand for indexes that incorporate these factors. The fixed income market has undergone and keeps undergoing also a rapid technological change. If you think about it, electronification of bond trading is really making its way into the market, and it has made it already. So it's being used in large scale. And then in addition to that, and this is close to my heart at MSCI and our heart, you know, with the Barra brand that we have, the risk models and the portfolio optimization and so on. We, you know, clients today benefit from what I call next generation portfolio management tools. They enable investors to efficiently replicate bond indexes in a much better way than that was possible 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago. So ultimately, if you think about how can passive strategies be ultimately implemented by an investor, the two most common ways is either with a passive mandate. So an asset owner hands out or gives out a mandate to an asset manager and is asking that asset manager to replicate the index. And then this what we internally call SMA, a separately managed account. And the other is an ETF. We probably see in continental Europe and in APAC a little bit more the mandate route happening. And then we see in northern parts of Europe and to a certain degree also in some countries in continental Europe, the ETF route. So where clients say, look, I like the idea of having a daily or even an intraday tradability feature with my investment that lets me run tactical allocations in a very quick, easy, and cost-efficient manner.
With that as background, the next logical question here seems to be, what have fixed income investors actually been doing? Or, to put it another way, what will we see when we follow the money?
There's been definitely some flows out of the U.S., but again, this is more of a tactical thing. I do think that it's opened up an allocation toward emerging markets pretty substantially. When we look at the performance of, let's call it dollar-denominated markets across U.S. high-yield emerging markets and treasuries, the performance is not very different across the board. Now, there's definitely differentiation when we think about the overall volatility year to date. But if we start to just take a step back and think about performance in U.S. government bonds, we're up 2.5% year to date. Investment grade credit is about 2.25%. High yield is at 2.75% year to date. And EM sovereigns is roughly in line with U.S. high yield and EM corporates. But if we come back to emerging markets, and I think the demand is really going to come into play with local markets more than anything, because that's where most of the attention is going to. And interesting enough, a lot of emerging markets, local market products today are hedged. But where we see the demand is really coming in around the FX. And when we look at the US dollar being down 8% so far this year, it's basically a tailwind for EM, and obviously EM local markets being the main beneficiary of that. Now, historically, EM local markets and primarily FX has been an underperformer due to the FX component. But when you start to think about overall volatility and alpha generation and where the dollar is today, FX becomes a real structural allocation and meaningful way to provide a bit more alpha and outperformance in our overall portfolio. But with all that being said, I'm keen to see how the market kind of repositions these hedge strategies into potential unhedged strategies to go back and grasp the alpha or the volatility within FX markets in itself. Because naturally, a weaker dollar is going to mean more positive outperformance for EMFX as a whole.
The FX trade, not to oversimplify it, was all about the strong dollar. And now that that seems to have been shifting, it's a different ballgame. Am I understanding that correctly?
That is correct. So there's two scenarios here when we think about emerging markets. There's dollar-denominated emerging markets, but then there's also local currency. Now, the dollar-denominated market has been around for a very, very long time. And then that's kind of transcended into local markets. And the idea here was to kind of double dip from an investor perspective, where you get rate return or credit, local credit return, plus the return of FX. And when EM local markets actually came to fruition, there was a huge amount of demand because FX, EM FX has performed so well. But then there was a 10-year, maybe even a bit longer than that period, where EM FX was the dog of the performance because the dollar was strengthening so much. And now when you see that the dollar is actually weakening, it provides more of an allocation toward EMFX, where you can kind of go back to those happy days where if you ever run, let's call it an efficient frontier model, you have a good allocation toward EM local markets because of the double dipping, where you have the rate return or credit return and the FX component providing alpha generation opportunities.
EM activity, is relatively strong. But generally, you won't necessarily see a switch from DM debt to EM debt per se. I mean, the flows can definitely switch direction a bit, but they're almost different asset classes. They're certainly different sub-asset classes, but the asset classes almost act independently from one another. Certainly in the government debt market, the XUS trade is absolutely become more popular. So investors are looking at the entire global developed market debt, and they're looking for other safe havens. It hasn't been a fire sale out of treasuries, but they're certainly balancing much more than they have previously.
What about in other areas of the debt market then, if you say that's government debt?
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that, I mean, from a credit issuance standpoint, the thing that we luckily have not gotten into, we have not had a difficulty in liquidity and credit, and when you talk about, the major financial crises that we've seen, going back to the global financial crisis and certainly crises before that, credit crunches are almost always a component of it where liquidity dries up, issuance dries up. The ability to get out of positions becomes difficult and expensive. We have not experienced that, which is great. So the health of the corporate credit market, the demand remains very strong. So new issue is having no problem getting placed. People are having no issue getting out of secondary. The market has evolved so much. In my, my career before MSCI, I ran different trading businesses for Bloomberg and for Tradeweb, who are both our major players in the electronic trading space. And that the evolution of that market of electronic trading for at first governments, but then into corporate credit, and then into the derivatives that underlie it, really has made for much broader market efficiency. Things that used to trade by appointment over the phone, now have much deeper liquidity from many different players. The evolution of what's happened with the sell side, where the traditional sell side in terms of liquidity provision have been joined by new entrants, it's changed dramatically. And therefore, while we're seeing a lot of volatility in equity prices, a lot of volatility
In the treasury market and the longer end of the treasury market, the corporate credit market has maintained a tremendous amount of efficiency. And I do believe that the electronification of the market is a part of that. And then certainly the increasing breadth of liquidity providers is also a major factor in that.
Just a bit of a tangent here, if I could, because right there was that idea of tech again. You might recall that Mark raised this idea earlier when he was talking about the shift to passive investing for fixed income investors. And unless you thought we'd get through an episode without raising the idea of AI, I will simply note here that regardless of macroeconomic, geopolitical situations, whatever we find ourselves in, what does seem certain is that the world of investing is not going back to a pre-AI world, and that will have significant effects. And now, if it pleases our coming AI overlords, let's turn to another area of the market that's getting a lot of attention recently: derivatives, and how investors have been using them to address volatility and other risks. I'm talking here about the world of futures, options, and other strategies with a dependency on other assets.
We're in a period of significantly higher volatility than we have been for really going back to the beginning of the COVID crisis. The markets have been, you know, very, very low volatility. If you look at the VIX index, you know, below 20, below 15 and 12 at times. And then we've had this massive shock, right, that's come in from the tariff standpoint. What that has resulted in is a great deal of activity, you know, in the listed derivatives markets. And looking at, you know, some of our numbers, we've seen strong activity, you know, in some of our largest futures contracts, you know, emerging markets, you know, incredibly active, EFA, incredibly active in terms of overall throughput of trades, really stepped up quite a bit as a result of that. Again, I think people are looking at the ex-US trade. EFA, of course, is world ex US and Canada. So we've seen significant flows there. We've also seen sharp pickups in the open interest of those futures contracts. And there's no question people are absolutely, you know, placing, you know, bets, and they're also hedging existing positions that allows for a bit of diversification away from the US. And we're seeing that, you know, on our, you know, on ICE, which is our U.S.-based exchange partner, as well as Eurex, who's our major European exchange partner.
And are you seeing differences in preference between the exchange-traded versus over-the-counter instruments?
OTC, OTC has always been a huge area for MSCI derivatives. So every major bank in the world, you know, their trading desks, their Delta One trading desks, all have partnerships with us for OTC product creation. OTC is a bit of an opaque market. You know, there are some reporting that goes into BIS, you know, and to other sources where you can sort of gauge what's going on the equity OTC market. Without question, activity is definitely up in terms of overall trades. Unlike futures, where you get a sense of direction, you know, you don't get that, you know, in OTC because the reporting is not there. But without question, the balances are definitely rising. And, you know, again, in listed, we've seen such strong pickups in activity.
Most of the derivative activity within fixed income is going to remain within the CDX market. And that's despite there being a huge amount of tracking error toward underlying bond portfolios in itself. Now, when I talk about CDX, the interesting part is, and you talk about some of the volatility within the derivative framework, when you start to compare daily volumes and comparing Q1 2025 volumes versus Q1 2024, so year over year, the trading volumes have actually tripled based on the data sets that we have. And when we look at the daily numbers today, it's roughly in the range of 16 to 17 billion US. And if I had to be very frank, I would expect a larger increase in Q2 year over year, but we have yet to see those numbers as of yet.
What does all that tell you in terms of how clients are managing risk right now?
So what that tells me is that there's obvious concerns. There's concerns for defaults. There's concerns of liquidity in itself, because these instruments tend to be very liquid, but they need to figure out ways to hedge out maybe some of their unliquid allocations in their portfolios in itself. But I think overall, it says that there is concerns, there's uncertainty.
So, you know, in the U.S., at least, we have data that comes from the CFTC called commitment of traders data. What we're seeing is, versus the last, you know, major volatility shock going back to the onset of COVID again, where we saw huge volumes, but open interest went way down, right? People were selling, closing out positions, They weren't really getting short the market, but they were just trading off. This time, we're actually seeing rising open interest. So we're seeing very high volume, but OOI rising. And the COT data is very balanced between buyers and sellers. So I think what that suggests is, number one, the health of the market is very, very strong, right? So we're not getting overextendedly long or short. We're seeing more usage, and therefore people are being taking advantage of the hedging tools that are out there for them. We're also seeing some transition of OTC into listed activity. Listed futures are generally traded at a lower price point than OTC, depending on where funding costs may sit. But for sure, it's a more efficient trade, and you see that in global markets around the world. You know, MSCI obviously has a ton. I think that it certainly means that there's more defensive positioning going on, but that the market's also reacting, in a healthy and efficient way to the volatility.
Okay, so we've got global concern related to U.S. tariffs uncertainty, a bit of at least a tactical move of money outside the U.S. as a reaction to that uncertainty and the decline in the U.S. dollar. And we also have an uptick in the use of different hedging strategies, including derivatives. But I did promise you at the top of the program that we'd try and look beyond the short term and talk about longer term trends as well. And so if the short term comes down to the word volatility, according to our guests, the long term is all about customization.
The well-known benchmarks, you know, the Bloomberg aggregate benchmarks, the JP Morgan emerging market benchmarks, the ICE / Bank of America high yield benchmarks. I think those spaces are pretty well saturated, right? No one's looking for, you know, a new ag index per se. But what they are looking for is they're looking for customized solutions. And certainly in our fixed income business, our fixed income index business, you know, that is our sweet spot. We're working with clients all over the world that are looking at, you know, fixed income benchmarks that they want to customize, you know, whether it be target dates, they want to look at a multi-asset class index that blends fixed income and equity, or they want to look at sustainable solutions. And I know that that's obviously something that's gotten, you know, come under some pressure, but without question, you know, we continue to find clients, you know, in the US, in Europe, in APAC, you know, that are very, very focused on those type of solutions.
And where do derivatives fit into this equation?
Yeah, so I mean, fixed income and derivatives are at a collision point right now. So what we've seen is that, you know, in the fixed income markets, obviously the interest rate markets have had derivatives for a long time. You know, U.S. Treasuries and you know, other global fixed income asset classes have very, very deep liquid futures markets, option markets that underlie those as well. So that's been there for a long time. The credit side of the equation really has been, you know, heavily underserved. You know, the evolution of credit default swaps and credit default swap indexes, CDS indexes, you know, that's where many market participants really go to hedge credit risk. They're inherently problematic, mainly because of the fact that it's not a bond index, it's a CDS index. The correlation to, you know, the standard bond indexes is relatively low. The default process is very, very messy in terms of determining, you know how you refactor the CDS index. There's conflict of interest problems as well that have haunted those. But they are the standard, and they are extremely liquid from a trading standpoint. Which is why they're widely used. Credit futures is a new evolution in the market. MSCI, has partnered with MarketAxess and ICE in the development of our first credit indexes, liquid credit indexes, and then we launched the futures on ICE. There's other competing products in the market, but the products are newly launched. There's a lot of onboarding going on around them, and also the overall credit future picture is still in its early days. But the clients specifically and the banks, recognize the efficiency of these products.
I mean, as you know, MSCI has a rich suite of fixed income standard indexes across credits and rates in global developed and emerging markets. We also have many off-the-shelf indexes with sustainability and or climate risk overlays. But you asked me to talk about customization, not standard indexes. So it's also true that in 9 out of 10 client meetings, the client engagement, it leads to a customized solution. After all, every investor is at their specific point in the transition journey. Some have just started, while others are considering a decarbonization strategy in the near future. And objectives as well as constraints, they vary from investor to investor. Now, I would like to break down the customization projects into two categories. Number one is a top-down approach whereby clients ask us to modify a standard index methodology according to their preferences. This could be, for example, loosening or tightening certain exclusion thresholds or decarbonization trajectories. In contrast to this, other investors want to start with us on a blank sheet of paper. Such a bottom-up process starts with a profound understanding of investors' goals and their constraints, and then matching those with the rich set of ingredients that MSCI can bring to the table. For example, sustainability and climate metrics, bond or bond issuer specific data, index construction techniques, hedging overlays, and so on and so forth. In Europe, the appetite for sustainable investment solutions, it remains solid, specifically in the segment of pension funds, insurances, public institutions, central banks, and so on. For many, this transition is centered around climate, supplemented by specific sustainability overlays such as ESG ratings or exclusions based on business involvement screens, controversies, global norms, and so on. We also observe an increasing interest to include sustainable development goals, SDGs, into the portfolio. Now, if we want to dive a layer deeper into this, the next question is then for the specific climate overlay. What does it look like? Some investors tend more towards tilting approaches, so excluding only a small number of issues and issuers, such as producers of controversial weapons, to name an example. The benefit is relatively low tracking errors versus market portfolios and modest increase in turnover. And the fact that most of the bonds in the universe, and with that, most of what an active manager would call alpha opportunities, are retained. At the other end of the spectrum, indexes which are part of the EU taxonomy, such as Paris-aligned benchmarks, PAB, or climate transition benchmarks, CTB, are preferred by some investors, but in particular in Europe. They are much stricter. They have significant exclusions, hence the starting portfolio would, shrink by 30, 40, sometimes 50%. And they apply a certain relative and a certain year-on-year decarbonization rate. The reality for many asset owners lay in between these two ends of the pole. Many of our clients are interested to learn how their portfolios and their way of investing can help to finance energy transition. So those are clients who want to embed forward-looking measures like science-based targets or MSCI's proprietary and innovative low-carbon transition scores into the methodology. This is very more and more in focus here. We see a very similar pattern in APAC. You have like markets who are, you know, in Australia and New Zealand, which have maybe you know, some more similarities than the UK market. And then you have markets in the northern part of APEC, like Japan and Korea, where at the margin, you know, other sustainability and climate preferences are pursued. But again, this wide range of index methodologies, standard, and then in particular customized, it really allows even such a large region to, you know, to being serviced properly.
It's worth noting that this move toward greater customization is alive and well across many asset classes, and we'll definitely continue to follow up on this program. But as we approach the end of this episode, I can't help but return to the fact that despite everyone's best intentions, it's just simply very hard to hear anything beyond all the noise of the moment.
We're in a headline-driven place, right? So, and there's so much going on now around economic policy, monetary policy, fiscal policy, as we talked about. It's so difficult to tell, you know, the direction of things. So I do think that, you know, a really strong hedging program for any investor, retail, institutional, is going to become more and more important. The open interest in our min-vol futures has gone up, you know, dramatically. So I think that that's going to be, you know, a big factor. I think customization for sure will, you know, will maintain as a huge area of demand, both in the creation of custom baskets or customization on the indexes themselves, or a mix of the two. And then, as I just touched on with the credit derivatives and credit futures, I think that, you know, hedging, you know, for, you know, as I said earlier, you know, we haven't seen, you know, a lot of pressure on the credit markets yet. If that becomes a factor, people will absolutely be looking for hedging tools. And I think that they'll do much more with those credit futures as we start to see that.
That's all for this week. Many thanks to George, Mark, and Jared, and to all of you for listening. Remember, you can find more insights on fixed income and derivatives on the Research and Insights pages on MSCI.com. Next up on the program, we shift gears to look at another issue that continues to challenge investors. That is the shifting landscape of debt, specifically as it pertains to real estate and the face-off between buyers and sellers. Until then, I'm your host, Adam Bass, and this is MSCI Perspectives.